A light winter rain descends in weak pulses over the ocean, is buffeted across a flattened tide-built beach by a fresh wind, and rolls up into the mountains. A female rain, a swirling mist. Farther north, a heavier rain, what the Navajo call a male rain, is falling hard and trundling this way, southward out of the Gulf of Alaska. I start off searching along the high tide line. I'd learned about the storm last night, as it was starting to build below the arc of the Aleutian Islands, bringing wind-slanted sleet and 50-foot seas to the Gulf. A few hours ahead of it, trawlers were hauling their nets and battening hatches. The next morning, as it was bearing off farther to the south, I'd put a few things in my truck and driven to the coast, 150 miles through the mountains west of my home. I wanted to be in it, to feel it thrashing Cape Foulweather, to know the punch of it against my back, to inhale the ionized air, infused with the smells of fish and trees. I'm straddling a serpentine rack line of kelp fronds just now, which binds together broken bits of razor clamshell, scraps of salt-encrusted, sunburnt plastic, gull feathers, empty water bottles, kelp bladders, and the vacant carapaces of shore crabs. I hope one day to discover a glass float from a Japanese fishing net in these rack lines, but it won't be today. Another 100 yards farther along, ducking down from the humid air accumulating like dew on my face, I retrieve a ball cap. Inscript across the plastron are the words Calico Enterprises. My mother taught me to recognize calico cloth when I was young, a plain, serviceable cotton the British once exported from India. Before that, I'd assumed the word referred only to the patterned color of a horse or a cat. I recall her instructing me about the many fabrics she used: worsted wool, chambray, complicated jacquard weaves like damask and brocade. She spoke of what she called the hands of these cloths, the fine, silky feeling of batiste, the stiffness of organdy, the coolness of linen. I saw these textures everywhere in nature later, a late recalled gift from my mother's concern about my education. I carry the hat absent-mindedly another few hundred yards, then place it back on the rack line for someone else to find before a spring tide takes it away. I pick up a half dozen other things to scrutinize: a doll's eyeless head, a cormorant's long primary feather, but hold on to nothing. The informing history behind flotsam and jetsam notwithstanding, an hour more of this flannery, and I turn around, putting my back to a damp north breeze. I cover the same ground once more, then walk up the shallow slope of the beach, fists in my pockets, to a paved parking area, where my dark gray truck sits by itself. I head south on the Oregon Coast Highway. A few miles on, I turn left and drive east into the mountains on a gravel road that parallels a creek. A mile in, I cross the creek on a stout timber bridge and enter a maze of narrow logging roads. The roads I follow climb hillsides through deep-shadowed copses of spruce and cross over tracts of upended land shorn of its trees. The last spur I turn onto climbs up a steep grade to a landing, part of an old logging operation below the heights of the Cape, about half a mile inland and 600 feet or so above the Pacific. The slope below me is planted to young Douglas fir trees, 5 or 6 feet tall now. I guy my tent in the lee of the truck and begin making dinner on the tailgate. The wind is fitful, sodden, but real rain hasn't started to form yet. Harsher weather is still hours off, its leading edge probably somewhere near the Olympic Peninsula in Washington now. On the way in here, something strange caught my eye, a white thing in the logging debris of the scabland. I shut the truck's engine off and walked toward it, leaving the door ajar, the vehicle blocking the road. I threaded my way through the clear-cut sash and past debarked stumps, glaring skyward from the cratered earth. I stood before a white brassiere, as incongruous an object as I could imagine here. Its straps were stretched around the wide face of a stump and secured there with pushpins. Each cup had been painted with concentric orange rings. Each was punctuated with a half-dozen bullet holes. I pulled the bra free, shoved the wad of it deep into the weedy undergrowth, and started back toward the truck. No. I returned, retrieved it, and stuffed it under the driver's seat, thinking to put it in a trash receptacle in the town of Newport. Is it good, I wondered, to be drawn off by such things? Mute evidence of the malign cast of some human mind? Is it useless, perhaps even wrong, to hide the evidence? Should one just give misogyny its quarter? Is it hopelessly naive to think that by preventing others from being confronted by such things, there will be fewer imitators? I also wondered whether you might ever find such signs of degeneracy in the rural clear-cuts of Kalimantan or Sarawak. I suspect not. The incident rankled me, unduly.